Well, it's a pleasure to speak at Perimeter Institute virtually. It's probably best that we're speaking virtually because I'm in exam season here. So, yes, it would have been difficult to show on my own. Hang on, let's see. Maybe I didn't really want to turn off my video there. Try to undo that. Let's see, how do I undo this? Ah, maybe you don't need to see my video. Anyways, so let me start by just giving you a bit of a motivation, a reason to be interested in this sort of physics. I'm going to be telling you about scattering amplitudes in gravity. Now, gravity is very interesting right now. There's more than one reason why gravity is of interest. One reason is that gravity is a data-rich topic now, and there are a lot of interesting events being observed at gravitational wave observatories. And moreover, there's a very bright future in gravitational wave physics. So we expect, for example, the European Space Agency to fly this LISA mission in a couple of years, maybe 10 years. Now, this will be a very high precision gravitational wave observatory. And of course, there will also be other ones on the cards, ground-based ones. There are many observatories that people are thinking about. One recently made a lot of progress is LIGO India. So that joins the three current, four gravitational wave observatories at the moment, the two LIGO detectors, and Virgo and Kagra. There are also plans for more advanced ground-based detectors, which again will be very high precision instruments. So now, for theorists, that presents a challenge. We need to be able to predict gravitational waveforms at high accuracy, really pushing what we, certainly going beyond what we can compute at the moment. So there's a theoretical challenge out there. Now, there's another topic where there's a lot of data and where precision is required, which is close to many of our hearts. So that topic is particle physics. So here is, of course, a Higgs candidate event, sort of mandatory for any physicist from Edinburgh to mention the Higgs boson, I thought, so sort of buried away in the contract. Now, the interesting thing about gravitational wave physics, the stuff I want to tell you about, is that because of the progress in understanding amplitudes and their applications to gravity, there is a new application for the tools of collider physics in gravity. And I'll give you an explicit example of that a little bit later. Okay, now, on the other hand, gravity is also very interesting from a theoretical point of view. So one reason, many of the most interesting problems in physics really are ultimately related to gravity. But without even thinking about cosmological constant or anything like that, there's already something interesting in thinking about gravity and scattering amplitudes. So one thing that I'm particularly interested in is the double copy. The double copy is the statement that scattering amplitudes in gravity, like this amplitude here, so my double wiggly line indicates a graviton. So an amplitude like this can be expressed in terms of a product of amplitudes, two amplitudes in Yang-Mills theory. So the single wiggly line is a gluon. So this equality here, it just means that the amplitude in gravity is a sum of terms, both of which are involved two amplitudes in Yang-Mills theory. Now, there's many different ways of thinking about this. This double copy. The one here is due to Freddie and collaborators. So I decided, since there's such a quite a lot of work at Perimeter that's related to this topic, I decided to bold Perimeter Institute contribution. So you'll see that in many little slides. I might draw attention to it, but it's always there. Now, the double copy is a fact about scattering amplitudes. Sometimes people refer to the double copy as, the slogan is that gravity is the square of Young-Mills theory. So that's really meant in this sense, right? Some amplitudes are written as a sum of products of gauge theory amplitudes. But of course, this is a very bizarre fact from a more standard geometric point of view on gravity. One of the things I'll be telling you about is that nevertheless, this is there. It's also there in classical gravity. And we will use the double copy to compute observables of interest in classical gravity. A second thing that's interesting about amplitudes in gravity, particularly with the application to classical physics, is the unitarity method. So the unitarity method is a way of cooking up more complicated amplitudes from simpler amplitudes. So in this example, you start off with the simplest possible amplitude, a three-point amplitude, and build up more complicated things, loop amplitudes, two-loop amplitudes with many particles. The unitarity method, its main attraction in many ways is that it allows you to compute these amplitudes in an efficient manner. So because at each stage your building block is a scattering amplitude, and scattering amplitudes are simple, you can preserve a lot of the simplicity of your initial object while computing these multi-loop objects. So it cuts down on the labor of multi-loop computations. However, when we apply this to classical physics, again, it's very bizarre. We're using underlying property of quantum field theory to simplify computations in classical field theory. It's a peculiar thing. Now with this motivation, the idea of the talk is to build a method for computing classical observables from scattering amplitudes. And we want to see really how far we can push this. Now, as far as I know, sort of the basic idea here really goes back to Bryce DeWitt. The statement is that the only observable in quantum gravity or any gravity, classical gravity is the limit of quantum gravity, and the only observable in gravity in asymptotically flat space is the S matrix. So in other words, the amplitudes. So any observable you should think about should, from this perspective, be something we can extract from the scattering amplitudes in one way or another. Okay, so that's the sort of basic idea. Here's the overview of the rest of the talk. I'll start by talking about a little bit more detail about how I get observables from scattering amplitudes. And I'm going to focus on gravitational waves just because they're interesting. So observables associated with gravitational waves. Then I'll spend a little bit of time discussing, a little bit more of the technicalities of next leading order of computing gravitational waveforms using amplitudes. And finally, I'll finish with some discussion of space-time curvature and maybe a little bit more theoretical stuff I'm interested in. Let me also say that I welcome questions. So if you've got questions, please go ahead and ask them. You can just interrupt and mute yourself or, wherever that's best done. And ask your question.
Do you give a chance for any grad students to ask questions about the setup?
Oh, yeah, that'd be great.
We're trying to implement more of that. Anyone? If not, just keep going.
Okay, so let me talk about gravitational waves from amplitudes. So first of all, you might wonder what on earth have amplitudes got to do with this? Why have amplitudes got anything to do with gravitational waves? So now the reason is just a basic fact in quantum mechanics. There is a universal time evolution operator. So no matter what, if you give me some initial state in the far past, it doesn't matter what it is. I can time evolve that state to the far future with the time evolution operator. It's just a unitary operator that implements time evolution. Now, as a matter of notation, we call that unitary operator the S matrix. And we write the S matrix as 1 plus IT. The T then is the transition matrix. And the point where amplitudes come in is just the fact that the amplitudes, by definition, are the matrix elements of the transition matrix up to some momentum conservation delta function. So the reason why amplitudes come into this problem is very basic, and it is just that the amplitudes tell us about time evolution over long periods. That's what they're good for. Okay, so now let's talk about a specific problem of interest. Now let's take two black holes. Now I'm going to scatter them. Right? So I'll start off with some impact parameter B. So there'll be two black holes separated by some spatial distance B in the far past. And then I will just let them come together and interact. And as they do so, they will generate a peaky waveform like this. So instead of being the usual wiggly, chirp waveform that you might be familiar with from LIGO, the scattering waveform is more of a peak. Now, this particular waveform, as I'll say, it's a little bit more accessible from scattering amplitude, so that's why I want to focus on it. And in fact, it is given by an expression of this form. So essentially, you take a five-point amplitude, you perform some integration over it, which I'll discuss a little bit more detail, divide by some distance. Now, that's the distance between the observer and the source, and that gives you your waveform. And there are some additional terms, and I'll talk about them in a moment. So that's a basic observable I'm going to talk about. Some comments. I will work in the classical point particle approximation. So I'm really going to treat these black holes as point-like objects. So finite size effects, I'm going to assume are under control by some other means. And these finite size effects can be various things. Can be spin. Spin is very easy to include in this approach. There can be certain other finite size effects. Maybe if we're thinking about neutron stars, there's a whole load of them, and those could be included perturbatively, for example. So for now, I'm just going to leave them out. I'm happy to discuss them if people have questions about them. I'm also going to assume that my space-time is asymptotically Minkowskian, so there's no cosmological constant. Flat space very far away from our event. And I wanted to say that so I'm going to focus on this particular example, but there's very interesting related work by Fabian Battista and Mia Simpson. PI stuff. Okay, now, because I want to compute using scattering amplitudes, I have to use a quantum mechanical formalism to talk about this waveform. So the waveform of interest, rather than just being a classical quantity, is an expectation value of a quantum mechanical quantity. And the quantum mechanical quantity I'm going to take an expectation value of is the Riemann curvature operator. So that's now an operator in quantum field theory. The position x here, by the way, is supposed to be far away from the event. So this is some very basic Penrose diagram. So the position x, if you want, is close to future null infinity relative to the event, which is taking event takes place here in the center of space-time. Now, the waveform, more specifically that I'm talking about is, or more technically, is a Neumann-Penrose scalar, the Neumann-Penrose Psi 4. So this is one key quantity that you can think about when talking about waveforms. Essentially, what this Psi 4 is the dominant component of the Riemann curvature at very large distances. It's the component that falls off like one over distance. That's the term I'm really computing here. The state, the initial state I'm going to consider has this form. So it's basically a two particle state. So I'll take two particles, say scalar particles. They can be particles of scalar fields with totally different masses, or in other words, two different scalar fields. And now I want to have some sort of situation that makes sense also in classical field theory. So this initial state, I have to arrange it so that it's in the correspondence region. In other words, that the classical approximation is a good approximation to the quantum field theory. So in order to do that, I better put my particles into wave packets. I want them to have approximately well-defined momenta and positions. So here I'm thinking about putting particle one in a Gaussian wave packet and particle two in some Gaussian wave packet in momentum space. That means that their momenta you know, they have some uncertainty, but I'll assume that that uncertainty is small compared to other physical scales in my problem. There will also be some uncertainty in the position, which again, I'll assume is small compared to other scales in my problem. And I'll translate them with respect to one another by this impact parameter B. So as an example then, I mean, there are some scales associated with these wave packets. There'll be the uncertainty in position. I'll assume that that uncertainty in position is very, very small compared to the distance between them, B. Similarly, the uncertainty in the momenta, I assume that that's very small compared to the masses. And if you, you know, study inequalities like that, you can convince yourself that, you know, the correspondence regime is going to work just as it should in ordinary quantum mechanics, and then you can let the dynamics run, right? So the future state will also be in the domain of validity of the classical field theory. Okay, so this state psi then is really just chosen to have a sensible classical interpretation. And then you just let the dynamics go. So the final state is S on psi. So the scattering amplitudes will enter just because of time evolution. Okay, so that's the basic idea.
Yeah, can I ask one question? Just can you elaborate?
Yes, please.
I mean, I guess it makes sense that you're looking at expectation values of some operator, of like measuring the geometry in an initial state. But like, to what extent is it not also useful to just say, not have to worry about this anti-time ordered part there and look in a given scattering process, like the curvature operator near the out state? Can you say just more about why people are, sorry.
I guess it's hard to, you know, I mean, my perspective on this is I just want to have some observable that I think is well-defined. So, you know, having this, you know, this thing here, it's not really a big problem for us. I mean, you know, S dagger is also just going to be some bunch of amplitudes. So, you know, I mean, they'll have complex conjugates or whatnot, you know. But actually they tend to clean things up to have them there. So, you know, they don't really cause us any problems. You know, from a more particle physics point of view, you can consider things like cross sections or, you know, how many, you know, what's the actual spectrum of the radiated gravitons or something like that. And so from that perspective, maybe the interesting thing to look at in a sense is what happens when you act on psi with the S matrix. And that is interesting. I'll make some comments about it. You know, obviously, if you know S psi, you know, the final state and all of its details, then you've complete information. You can get whatever you want out of that. But yeah, I mean, the setup here in a way is targeted very specifically at recovering quantities that you can compute in classical field theory. So, you know, for example, you know, it's very comforting when the computations to be are straightforward to check that you get the same answer from the classical field theory and the quantum field theory. You know, it's also true, I guess, that our friends at LIGO and Virgo and Kagra, you know, have tool chains set up for compute, you know, for studying, you know, the quantities they're familiar with. So, you know, I mean, we're trying to give them information that can be useful for them. We don't want to tell them, no, throw out everything you've done and do it a totally different way. So there's maybe an element of pragmatism like that.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I guess I'm just thinking that if you can sort of complete set of states between S dagger and the R, then like the object on the right-hand side, like it's not an inclusive quantity anymore, but it's closer to like the memory effect stuff. And it doesn't seem like a priori a bad thing to look at, even if sure it doesn't have the same interpretation as a like Aaron Fessler.
I mean, yeah, indeed. Well, it's also true that when you're, you know, I mean, thinking about computing and perturbation theory, you know, the sort of the intermediate states that you can pick up here are limited. I think there's also limits in what you get from classical field theory. I mean, there's actually quite a lot of interesting things here, you know, even going beyond the classical approximation.
Thanks.
Anyway, yeah, I will make a, you know, well, maybe in a couple of slides, there'll be some other things that are related to the question. Okay, good. Any other questions? This is kind of a key point. Okay. Very good. So now, just taking this a little further, a little bit more detail, the Riemann curvature operator. Oh, yep.
Are we supposed to think of this as some kind of form factor of an insertion of a Riemann tensor operator? Is this like a form factor of a, or is this some?
I mean, you can think about it that way, I guess. Yeah.
Like, how is this computationally defined? You insert a factor of Riemann tensor in the path integral and compute the amplitude and presence of that, or?
Well, I'm just about to say a bit more about it, but yeah, I mean, maybe I should say a little bit more about it. Just insert the Riemann tensor operator as a quantum field and get ahead with computing my amplitudes, the basic idea. So the Riemann tensor, you know, is a bunch of derivatives of, you know, classically of a H field. So H is, the correction to, if I write the metric classically is G mu nu is eta mu nu plus H, the Riemann curvature perturbatively is a bunch of derivatives of H plus higher order terms, right? Now, each of these H's in this situation are going to have the structure of a term that has a 1/1 distance factor. That's again the distance between the event and the observer, and then terms that have 1/1 distance squared, etc. Now, for a LIGO application, 1/1 distance squared is 1/1 an astrophysical distance squared. So we can completely, they're just completely negligible. So you're really only interested in terms where there's one insertion of the perturbative metric. So we can write this Riemann tensor as just two derivatives of a H. And in quantum field theory, it works in just the same way. It's two derivatives of a H, but the H is now an operator in quantum field theory. So the H will be an integral, a non-shell integral over some phase space. This is this dk stuff here. Right? That's just some phase space integral. H will have an annihilation operator and a creation operator in its complex conjugate. It will also have a graviton polarization. Now, I've written that graviton polarization tensor as an outer product of two vectors. That's always possible. And these two derivatives in momentum space just bring down two k's. K's here is just the Fourier conjugate, if you want. It's the momentum associated with this graviton. So this waveform that I'm computing takes this form. So by the way, I mean, I have all these dots here. I just mean some components, whatever they are, they're the components that are the dominant ones that give you the Psi-4 scalar I'm trying to compute.
Now, one question is taking the, small G Newton limit versus I can talk about the full curvature tensor for a classical solution in GR, and I wouldn't just do the linearized guys.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, that's, of course, an interesting thing. I from a very pragmatic point of view, when I'm computing waveforms, thinking about LIGO, I really don't have to care about anything beyond the 1/1 distance. From a more fundamental point of view, of course, you'd like to get the full Riemann curvature. And I will, in a certain sense, and I think there's a very interesting discussion to be had about that. I'll come back to that maybe in the third section of the talk. Excellent. Very good. So now let me see. So again, this waveform essentially from phase space integral, because of the quantum field has phase space integrals, some various momenta, polarization vectors. The S psi and S dagger psi here arise because I'm taking an expectation value. Now, in this particular term, so there's a plus complex conjugate, which is just coming along for a ride. But in this particular term, this A of K here, now, it's an annihilation operator for some bunch of gravitons. And if it directly acts on this psi, it's going to give me zero, because my initial state just has massive particles in it. It doesn't have any incoming gravitational radiation. So if I replace this S with one, I will get zero. So in other words, I can therefore just replace this S with IT. This S dagger, it's a little bit different. So the one does contribute. So if I write this S as one plus one minus IT dagger, I will get two terms, these two terms here. So one of these terms is linear in T, it's just coming directly from that S. The other term has a T dagger T. It takes the T dagger from here, from the S dagger, and the T from the S. Right? So that is the full expression, plus complex conjugate. Leading order and distance.
What was asymmetric about the two of them? Because I would have thought if I just...
It's just because of my initial condition, I have no incoming gravitational radiation. So on the other side, this A acting here creates a graviton. So that won't be zero. Now, which isn't really that asymmetric. There's a plus CC. It'll be just the opposite way in the plus CC.
Okay. So,
But it's kind of handy to think about it this way because you can just take real parts. It's life easy. Okay, now just as a matter of nomenclature, I'm going to call this quantity, this product, or the sum, I should say, the sum here, the wave shape. It'll come back, right? But just, it's handy to have a name for these things, and you will, you'll see this name appear again later. And in the guts of this wave shape, though, there's two terms. One term is just a 5-point amplitude. And then there's an additional term, which has a product of amplitudes. Right? It's just T dagger T. I could put a complete set of states in here. I'll just get amplitudes. Right? So this whole waveform is going to come out. It's inevitable now that it will come out involving scattering amplitude. Now, I'm going to come back to this full story in a moment. But to begin with, let me just talk about the leading order case. At leading order, I just have to worry about this first term. The second term is going to have an additional perturbative factor, so I can ignore at leading order. So leading order, after a little bit of simplification, the expression for this waveform takes this form. So there's the 1 over distance factor, there's some integral to be done, and there's a 5-point amplitude, a tree amplitude. Now to get to this point, you have to do some analysis. It's very similar to the analysis we do when we're determining cross sections from first principles in quantum field theory. So there's at some stage in that story, there are wave packets, but then you do a little bit of analysis and then use some properties of the wave packets, and then they drop out, right? The wave packets drop out of the expression we use for cross sections, just the square of an amplitude integrated over phase space. The same way here, you have to use some properties of the wave packets I've assumed, but once you've used those properties, you can essentially forget about the wave packets and deduce an expression like this. So this is what you've got to compute at leading order to get the waveform. There's a Fourier integral to do, and that's a bit of an interesting bottleneck. It's related to some of the integrals we do in scattering amplitudes more traditionally, but a bit different. The space-time dependence comes in via that Fourier transform. So the space-time dependence here is just the impact parameter. And the omega here, by the way, is the frequency of the outgoing gravitational wave. It's somehow a little bit convenient to write this formula in frequency space. I could, of course, Fourier transform it to get it in the time domain. And then this 1 over distance factor is just the distance between the observer and the event. Okay, now, nice thing about this is the waveform comes out in terms of amplitudes, and amplitudes are things we can compute with a double copy. So you can compute this gravitational observable from the product of two amplitudes in Yang-Mills theory, no problem.
One other question, are you always are you putting the operator at scry plus, or are you bringing it into the bulk, and is it basically just kind of like boundary to bulk propagating from the on-shell amplitude, or?
So my operator is essentially at scry, scry plus. Maybe you don't have to think about it, completely there, but yeah, I mean, certainly you want to say there is a large separation between your LIGO and the.
But if you do that, you should be able to like reduce the, like you have a saddle point approximation, like Andy's story, right? You can probably.
There's a saddle point approximation if you want to get this 1 over distance. Yeah, maybe that's what you're doing. Yeah. And now at the same time, I do want to talk about amplitude. So I want to, assume that all the distances are very large and everything is really on shell. But I mean, that's a fairly modest thing. Yeah. So, excellent. Okay, good. So some comments on this now. Firstly, it's very nice. I mean, you can get gravitational waves without ever touching the Einstein-Hilbert-Lagrangian here. You can get them from amplitudes in Yang-Mills theory. That's one of the attractions of this approach. You never have to look at the Einstein-Hilbert-Lagrangian. You're still going to get gravity from it. But you might think that there's something very counter to intuition, right? Because I'm telling you that I'm getting a waveform, some classical quantity, from this sort of expression. It involves an amplitude for the production of one graviton. And one graviton is definitely not a classical field. Right? If you have a one graviton state, you know, the expectation value of the field operator would be exactly zero. So you might wonder what on earth has gone wrong. Something seems to have gone wrong from the point of view of intuition. Now, one comment is that things that really give you classical field expectation values, in, you know, the object in quantum field theory that gives you, you know, familiar classical field expectation values is a coherent state. Well, that's a state something like this. So the normalization, which I've suppressed here, there's an exponential of creation operators, and then some quantity called alpha that comes in. And this alpha, again, it's something I call the wave shape. Really what I mean is the wave shape. It's the Fourier, you know, classically speaking, this alpha are the Fourier modes of the classical field. From the point of view of the coherent state, they appear in this form. So they're just a parameter multiplying the creation operator. You have to integrate over to get the coherent state. So if I had something like this, you know, you would understand, oh, of course. The field operator will have an expectation value. The expectation value will be given by this alpha. So what's going on? So I'm talking about something with the one graviton. How on earth can it connect to this coherent state? Now, so this, this sort of clash with intuition is resolved if the amplitudes obey a particularly nice property. So now, this isn't proven. This is a conjecture. But the notion here is that if you compute S psi, so not the expectation value I was just talking about, but if you say, oh, I don't need to compute the expectation value, I'm very strong, and I will just take my initial state and hit it with the time evolution operator. Well, then the idea, the conjecture is that the result takes this form. So there's some term here, which exponentiates basically a four-point amplitude, and then some other term that exponentiates, which is essentially a five-point amplitude, multiplying some creation operator. So, now this statement here is a generalization, a kind of generalization of a familiar kind of exponentiation known as the iconal exponentiation. It's studied a lot by people like Cefalonia, Colfry, and Veneziano, and a lot of recent work on iconal exponentiation in this black hole situation by Gabriele Veneziano, Paolo Di Vecchia, Rodolfo Russo, and Carlo Heisenberg. Now the idea then is that the clash with intuition is resolved because the amplitude, this 5-point amplitude here, exponentiates, and when you take the expectation value of this SI on a Riemann curvature tensor, you just drag down one power of this and you get that formula again. So the formula is perfectly correct. The clash with intuition is resolved, provided this this happens. Sabrina, you have your hand up.
One more question is that basically, so this is what's used by like Sasha and the first derivation of like the soft theorems, where basically extra photon, like in a Poisson distribution or whatever the distribution is the same expectation value.
This is very much the same idea.
Is intuition really that bad in the sense of like, I mean, it's Ehrenfest theorem, right? It's not, I understand that it's not like the state is diagonalizing it, but it, like the thing they're computing should obey the classical equations of motion because of Ehrenfest theorem, right?
I mean,
you don't need this feature of
the Yes. Yeah, I would agree with you. I mean, the Ehrenfest theorem should hold here, and you know, the object you're computing should indeed obey. And particularly when I've set up these initial conditions so that quantum effects are negligible, there should really be no issue. But still, you might wonder what's going on. I mean, it does seem a bit funny to say that, gosh, I'm getting this classical object by just looking at a one graviton production process.
I guess I always get confused between what I needed, like, you know, in the memory story, like, is it really the statistics of the soft radiation, or if it's just the Ehrenfest theorem thing, and I've been careful about my...
No, I mean, it's a good comment. I mean, I guess I usually think about that as being about the statistics, you know, that, you know, you've got this Poissonian distribution. Yeah. Now, essentially, the statement here is that, the physics idea here is that all of these gravitons in this state, you know, the very large number of gravitons in the gravitational wave are all emitted independently.
Yeah.
that's the basic idea. Yeah. Still, I mean, to my knowledge, this statement here is non-trivial. Actually, this has an enormous number of consequences for scattering amplitudes at all orders. Yeah, any number of loops, any number of legs. So, sort of interesting. Yeah, an interesting proposal. Good. Yes. Very good. So now another. Let me make another comment. Coming around to bound binaries. Now, of course, most of LIGO physics people care about bound states. So situations where black holes aren't scattering, but the black holes are actually orbiting around one another and generating gravitational waves. These are the processes that have been observed. Now, there's sort of a basic balance law in that situation, that the gravitational wave power, the power being emitted into the gravitational waves, is a derivative, a time derivative, the rate of change of the binding energy. Right? So if you know what the potential energy of the bodies are, that these two black holes, well then, if you impose this equation, then you can figure out the time dependence of the radius, etc. Basically figure out the chirp. Now, so there's two kinds of things that you want to know about then. Like to know about gravitational wave power, and you'd like to know about the potential between these two black holes. So both of these things involve some perturbative computations in general relativity. The potential, obviously, is essentially the Newton potential plus various corrections. And the wave power is the quadrupole power, the Einstein quadrupole power, with various corrections. So one way you can go about thinking about bound states, from a scattering amplitude point of view, is to say, well, look, with scattering amplitudes, the hint is in the name, we're very good at computing scattering. So let's build an effective field theory that links the bound regimes and the scattering cases. So we'll do some computations in the scattering case, fix Wilson coefficients that we don't know in this effective field theory, and now use the effective field theory in the bound state case. A basic idea, which has motivated a lot of work in this field. So that means, I've been talking about quantities like this, something to do with emission of gravitational waves, but people also care about figuring out the potential. That's something about 2-to-2 processes. So to get the potential, you're going to look at a bunch of diagrams like this. To understand the power, you're going to look at some diagrams like this. There are various corrections in both cases. We try to fix those corrections from scattering and then use the effective field theory in the bound state case. That's one way to link this physics to bound binaries. There may be a more direct route. I'm optimistic that it's possible to do a more direct analytic continuation, but so far, there's maybe one encouraging result from Bautista and Siemensen, but so far that's still something that this more direct analytic continuation is still a hope rather than something that I know how to do. Okay, very good. So now what I'd like to do is talk a little bit more about some of the scattering amplitudes points maybe in this generation of gravitational waves next to leading order. So I'll return then to this expression for the waveform, now including both terms. So there's a term here with one power of t, and there's an additional term which has two. So these are all together in this wave shape. Now the second term here, it's one way to think about it is the cut of an amplitude. So you can put in a complete set of states here and realize this is some cut of a scattering amplitudes. Now, cuts of scattering amplitudes are also related to imaginary parts of scattering amplitudes. So this thing here, because it has two particles in the psi, two particles in this psi, and some creation operator, basically some sort of a five-point object. In particular, this becomes a cut of a five-point amplitude, an imaginary part of a five-point amplitude, something like that. So this whole expression, roughly speaking, looks like it's at next to leading order, looks like a one-loop amplitude from here and one-loop five-point amplitude, I think, something like this, and an imaginary part of a one-loop five-point amplitude, something like that. Yeah. But now if you're subtracting, you know, with an I, the imaginary part, you know, from the 5-point amplitude, the 1-5-point amplitude, the whole thing looks a little like the real part of the 5-point amplitude. So that's a little bit hand-waving, right? And in fact, when you look into it, it's a little bit more subtle than that. It is more subtle because there's more than one cut in 5-point amplitudes. In particular, there's a cut like this involving massive particles in the loop. But there's also a cut like this where there's just there's a graviton as well as a massive particle in the loop. What you find is that this cut is removed in the subtraction to make the wave shape, but this one remains. And there's some interesting physics in that. Let's see. So I see that there's a question.
Yeah, I have a question about the previous slide. When you say you go to next order, so one question is that when you at some point you made an approximation about what is the curvature. The curvature contains nonlinear terms which are higher order in G Newton, and you threw them away because you only took the linear part of the.
Although I wouldn't say they're higher order in G Newton. They're higher order in 1/1 distance. So already here, there's all sorts of terms at any power of G Newton, which are leading order in 1/1 distance. And all of those terms are relevant for LIGO waveforms. But in LIGO, you do not care about 1/1 distance squared.
No, but there's
So this quadratic term in the curvature are 1/r².
They're all 1/r² because H is always 1/r.
But like, so various components of the vowel tensor will involve quadratic pieces of the same order in 1/r, at least near the corners that like, so maybe these are just different components of the vowel tensor then?
That's absolutely right. So I'm computing psi 4. So that's just the part, a part of the vowel tensor includes the dominant 1/r correction. Right? So I'm throwing away anything that's 1/r². I'll come back to that. I will include, well, I'll talk about, you know, other parts of the vowel tensor after I talk about gravitational waves. Yes. So here I'm just computing psi 4. I'm only computing the 1/r part of the vowel tensor.
Okay,
good. It's interesting and important to realize that, you know, even though I'm computing just one part, it has a very non-trivial expansion in G nu. So this is the next leading order part. Okay, so as I said, the waveform removes certain cuts, but it keeps other cuts. And that's a little bit interesting because you find that you can write this wave shape in the following way. So there's one term, which is the real part of a one loop scattering amplitude. And then there's another term, which involves computing, how to think about this. So you can think about this as a product of two trees integrated over phase space. Or you can think about it as a specific cut of a one loop 5-point amplitude. In particular, it's the cut where there is an intermediate graviton. Now, these are two well-defined gauge invariant parts of the gravitational wave shape. And so it's interesting to wonder, think a little bit about the physics. There's some physics going on here. Now, in this real part, when you're taking the real part, you find that, essentially the real part messes around with I epsilons in Feynman propagators. I always start out with Feynman propagators because I'm computing scattering amplitudes. But when you take real parts, you're going to have, one propagator has an I epsilon, another's got a minus I epsilon because it's a real part. When you look into it in detail, the result is, while computing this real part, you must have one massive propagator that is replaced by a delta function. Those I epsilons add up so that you get, an on-shell delta function for one massive particle. All the other propagators in this real part turn out to be replaced by principal value prescriptions. So you can sort of forget about the Feynman I epsilon and just take principal parts of the propagator. And the result of that, putting these together, the result is that the force involved isn't dissipative. So this thing has time reversal invariance property. So the force involved is not itself intrinsically dissipative. So it's like geodesic motion or the Lorentz force in electrodynamics. But the imaginary part is different. So in this imaginary part, there's two propagators here that I've indicated are both cut. So there's delta functions for two of them, including this massless propagator. There's an explicit factor of I, which means that you're breaking time reversal invariance. So this part of the wave shape is the radiation caused by an intrinsically dissipative force. So basically what's going on here is this part knows about radiation reaction, you know, the radiation reaction forces around Lorentz Dirac in the case of E and M, it's equivalent in gravity, whereas this part doesn't. So this is sort of non-dissipative and this is dissipative. So there's a very nice sort of physical interpretation here. So as far as I know, this is the simplest example of radiation reaction in, you know, appearing in quantum field theory. There's a direct connection to renormalization of loop diagrams in quantum field theory. So there's a sort of very interesting story regarding this particular term here. Now, when you go ahead and compute all of these quantities, compute this alpha, well, there's quite a lot of work to be done. It has been done. So here are results from these groups who've computed this this quantity next to leading order. And I've taken a figure from the first group, Herjavsky and all. So this is the G squared corrections, the 1/r part of the waveform. So they've normalized it in some simple way and plotted it from various different velocities, initial velocities of these two black holes that are scattering, you know, for fixed impact parameter. And the methods that were used is just the, you know, really the collider physics toolbox. So people used the integration by parts identities to compute the loop integrals, a bunch of loop integrals that appear. I guess a more accurate statement is these integration by parts identities were used to reduce all of the integrals to a basis. Generalized unitarity was used to build the actual integrands. Some folk, many of them used a HQET, so heavy quark effective theory, basically a heavy particle expansion. In order to, it's one way to simplify the computations, you know, simplify the amplitudes. The double copy was used to build again the integrands. And a final comment, which is I think interesting, is that there are IR divergences, infrared divergences, which are left over at one loop. And they actually survive in the classical theory and are can be removed in a specific way. So there are infrared divergences in classical observables. But this is just just as an example, you know, really there are applications for these collider physics tools in gravity. Another comment maybe about this was interesting. This is the first time this quantity was ever computed. So, this is a gravitational quantity, classical gravitational quantity computed for the first time using scattering amplitudes. There are other examples, this is just one. Okay. So so much for gravitational waves.
Can I ask a question? Do you know how, like, yeah, sure. Just vaguely sociologically, how does this tie into like Thibault de Moore's like version of when he's trying to use amplitudes to compute like these propagators without any? Sorry, it's not really amplitudes because it's not Feynman propagators, but
some things are. Let me see. So, well, this is this post-Minkowskian approximation in Thibault's language, so. Now, Thibault, I think, is, you know, he spends a lot of time actually computing, you know, thinking about bound state processes. So, I mean, while Thibault, I think, is interested in post-Minkowskian scattering, his personal focus is obviously on bound states. But there are aspects of this which are quite similar to some things that Thibault likes to, is interested in. For example, his principal value prescriptions are relevant for him, for his approach in many cases. You know, this business about how the dissipation arises here. So it actually arises through shot terms, which again are of interest, I think, to Thibault. So there's definitely overlap in some respects with Thibault's work.
But sociologically, for you guys, you want to basically import like these double copy, like these techniques to compute amplitudes more efficiently to help.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, of course, it depends on what your what your particular interest in life is. I mean, for me, I'm very interested in the double copy. It's a rather fascinating thing. So my personal motivation is more along those lines. And you know, I mean, my fantasy future. I hope that indeed we can perform some analytic continuation and really make contact more directly with bound state stuff, which maybe Thibault is, you know, personally more involved with. certainly there's been a lot of discussion with LIBO, which has motivated a lot of these computations. I think one comment that LIBO might make is that, you know, in terms of the methods here that have been particularly impactful on his side of these computations, he's impressed with the methods people have for performing integrals. No matter what you do in the story, when I mean, you can settle the computation in many different ways, but you always hit integrals that are difficult. And the methods of scattering amplitudes are really very good. Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Maybe just a question along the same line. Like, when you say it's the first time these things have been computed, you mean, in post-Newtonian, they haven't computed the same things? Like,
this is post-Minkowskian. So, in post-Newtonian.
Post-Minkowskian. So, in post-Minkowskian, they haven't.
Not this specific observable, no. And the furthest that people took this one was at leading order. Yeah, so that was Kovac and Thorne. So this, yeah. In post-Minkowskian, people have computed other observables at higher orders. So, for example, the impulse, you know, the change of momentum as these two bodies scatter, that has been computed in post-Minkowskian perturbation theory at various orders. And yeah, certainly at this one loop or so. This is one loop, and one loop was computed a long time ago. Impulse in post-Minkowskian, but yeah, not this particular one. Potentially, why is that? I don't know. I mean, the integrals are difficult. I think after Kovac and Thorne, the motivation for the post-Minkowskian people to think about these waveforms has also decreased. So,
Okay. Thanks.
Okay, so my last topic then, which I'll try to be brief on, so I see time is running out, will be space-time curvature. Just to get us going here, I've been telling you that we can compute, the curvature, the gravitational waveform generated during some scattering process using a formula like this, right? So there's some integral of a 5-foot amplitude. You could do a very similar thing in Yang-Mills theory. You can compute the field strength when two charges scatter. Now, in gravity, this 5-point amplitude is a double copy of some 5-point amplitudes in Yang-Mills theory. So you could just consider the field strength associated with the amplitude that double copies into gravity. Right? So take these two charges, this 5-point amplitude, it would double copy into this 5-point amplitude. And then you can just decide to say that this field strengths double copy into that curvature, right, by a formula like this, essentially a definition of that. So it's just interesting to start thinking about these kind of field strengths. Now, of course, when you think about gravity, some of the fields that are most, celebrated in general relativity are the static field, like the metric of Kerr, the curvature of Kerr, or Schwarzschild. So now it'd be interesting if we can say something about that. Moving away from this case where I have two particles scattering, what about the curvature of one body? So if I want to think about that, just sort of outline a computation that you could imagine doing. Let's start trying to think about Schwarzschild. Well, Schwarzschild is the curvature associated with a scalar mass, right? No rotation of any kind. So suppose then I take an amplitude for a massive particle with spin zero, some amplitude like this, and let it couple to gravity. Right? So the lowest order coupling would be a 3-point amplitude like this. Now this 3-point amplitude is unique. It's the unique object coupling a spinless massive body to gravity. The explicit formula for the amplitude isn't that important for us. It involves kappa squared and g Newton up to some factors, right? And this M3, as this schematic form. So it's the polarization vector of this graviton dotted with the momentum of the scalar squared. So that's what the amplitude looks like. This is just the scalar QED amplitude. I'm just squaring it, the double copy. Very good. But anyway, the point here is this is the unique object in scattering amplitudes, coupling a massive body to gravity. So you'd think maybe it has something to do with Schwarzschild. I mean, Schwarzschild obviously has this uniqueness property too. Okay, now if I want to connect this amplitude to a space-time curvature, I'm going to have to introduce space-time coordinates somehow. So the obvious way to do it would be by a Fourier transform. That's what worked when we talked about dynamical curvature. So we consider doing a Fourier transform. There's one other thing to worry about. So this amplitude, although it's a unique object, involves four powers of spinners. So this spinner in this formula, it's just some quantity buried in the polarization vector. The point about the spinner is that it involves some choice of phase. You know, it's the same in a polarization vector. Polarization vectors involve some choice of phase, right? So from amplitude's point of view, it's nice to think about it from a spinner point of view. So there's something here that there's a choice of phase that has to be made before you can actually write down what these things are, you know, the epsilon or the k's. Okay, now there's certainly no issue of phase choice when you're talking about the curvature of Schwarzschild. So what I would like to do is get rid of that phase choice. And one way you do it would be multiplied by the complex conjugate, you know, the complex conjugate quantity. So in short, it seems like a reasonable thing to think about a formula like this. So this k is the complex conjugate of this k. So if I multiply these four k's by this amplitude, then the phase convention will drop out. I'll have introduced some space-time dependence through a Fourier transform, but maybe this is something to do with space-time curvature. Right? I should do some integral here over, you know, on-shell phase space. That's what we've always been doing. But that's where there's something a little funny, because this amplitude involves three particles all on shell. And in Minkowski space, the only solution for that would be to take the k to zero. So there's no solution for the on-shell phase space conditions for three particles there. The on-shell conditions for three particles are vacuous, have a vacuous solution in Minkowski space. But they don't have there's no problem with computing this amplitude if you analytically continue the momenta. In fact, that's a very common trick. Keep going back to Freddy. We often just analytically continue these momenta. To think about classical fields, it's convenient to analytically continue in the metric signature. So to go to plus plus minus minus metric signature, or to the more unloved metric signature, people are very happy with Euclidean and Minkowskian, and this is the other choice. But it is a very useful choice in scattering amplitudes. It's very, very natural to think about this analytic continuation. Now, if you do that, you paid that price, you'll do this analytic continuation, and then you perform that integral, well, you get something interesting. And the interesting thing you get out of it is the Schwarzschild curvature, and you, in fact, get the exact curvature of Schwarzschild. So that's an interesting thing that pops out, essentially. Now, there's a derivation of that, just the same derivation as the waveform I just discussed. But that derivation suffers from a bug, which is the derivation goes through in linearized theory, though the result that you get happens to be true to all orders. So that's a little bit interesting. Maybe I want to say that the same derivation goes through in the single copy in the gauge theory case, and you'll find the statement then that the double copy, you know, that the Coulomb charge double copies to Schwarzschild.
Can we pause here and talk a little bit about how you're, naively, I would have thought you're doing a weak coupling thing when you're just looking at the three-point coupling, and then you're getting roughly like the Coulomb, right, instead of the Schwarzschild, the Newtonian potential.
I'm definitely working relativistically. So I'm going to get something beyond Newton.
You're basically solving a spin two free wave equation rather than like GR, right? So like Schwarzschild versus.
So what's going on here, the connection to the exact file spinner goes back to something interesting in general relativity, right? Which is that essentially that Schwarzschild is the solution of a linear equation.
Okay.
So now that is true in an appropriate choice of coordinates or a choice of tetrad, depending on exactly how you want to think about this. So the coordinates are Kerr-Schild coordinates. Now I'm going to talk about other examples, maybe I won't because time's running out, but there are other examples which are double Kerr-Schild. But anyway, so there's some particular choice of coordinates where Schwarzschild linearizes. And one way you can think about this is that we're getting, this formula here spits out the curvature in the right coordinates. Now that's something about, this is the reason I circled this, the coordinate choice is sneaking in here through this Fourier transform. So, um, So yeah, I mean, it's a little bit elusive, an interesting thing. Now you could say that this is just good luck. I mean, if I were to compute higher orders, you know, I'll get the, you know, the curvature in some funny way. But yeah, you know, I mean, there's something going on in gravity here that it is true that you know, the gauge invariant data in Schwarzschild is there in the solution of a linear equation.
So just a question about that: is it true for Kerr too that you can linearize Kerr?
Yeah.
So any yeah, okay. Any of these metric where you just add a LL dagger.
Yeah. Very much. So all these, yeah. So they're.
But that's a bit of an accident.
I mean, I guess
it's kind of nice that you have these, these integrable null directions.
Yeah. But maybe I would.
Well, I mean, sorry, Sabrina, go on.
Oh, sorry. Maybe I would just think it seems like a little bit like an accident. I mean, I know it's probably not an accident, but there's a part of me that thinks like, okay, I start from a 3-point coupling and then I have to use some sort of gauge symmetry to complete that to the full like Einstein-Hilbert. So if I have diffeomorphism invariance or whatever, sure. Yeah. I could imagine three to tell you the rest, but I don't know where I'm using it. Like,
yeah, I think it's a little slippery. Yeah. I mean, it's also like, I mean, one thing to say, it is, although, you know, it's reasonable to say that this is in some ways an accident, it is also quite a pervasive accident. So this is true of any type D solution.
Yeah, exactly. So in type D, the condition is that psi zero is zero. Like you fix one of the psi to zero, and then you're sure that you're in type D and it's just LN. Yeah. Just an L square. So there must be that condition put in by hand there that, you know, you're in the the psi condition is zero.
I mean, of course, all the type D things are essentially all of the localized objects in gravity.
Yeah.
So I am putting in something localized, you know, I'm putting in some amplitude associated with the massive object. So indeed, that's localized.
But I mean, in the choice of coordinates, like, you know, you're picking, you have to pick one of the null directions to be one of the principal null directions.
Yeah. I mean, probably from an amplitude, my perspective, maybe it's a little bit more to do with the choice of tetrad, but yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, you know, I mean, you're really computing the Val spinner. It's the nice thing to compute. Yeah. Okay, maybe I'm sort of aware I'm getting over time, so maybe I can just quickly mention some generalizations of this. So one generalization, these are essentially what we've already talked about, but one generalization is to switch on an angle between your massive particle and just pure gravity. So this switches on an angle in the gravity, and it is essentially the magnetic mass. So you find the Tevenot solution. Another thing you can do is switch on a spin. So the spin is switched on by this particular deformation. So A here is the spin. Performing the integration, you'll find the Val curvature of Tevenot, the Val curvature of Kerr Tevenot. So the spin of Kerr comes in here. I switched off the theta, I'll just get Kerr. All of these have interpretations also on the gauge theory side. So there's some double copy from Schwarzschild, from Coulomb to Schwarzschild. You can switch on spin to get to Kerr, but also on the gauge theory side, you can switch on the spin, some solution, which is somehow the square root of Kerr under this double copy. And there are magnetic versions of this as well. So spinning dion is the thing that double copied to Kerr Tevenot. And that's what I wanted to say. So I think, you know, in conclusion, I think there's kind of an interesting dialogue between amplitudes and gravity. I think it's been a lot of fun. I'd like to emphasize that I've learned a lot about amplitudes from the gravity. I hope that our amplitudes are contributing to gravity at the same time. I think it's, from my perspective, interesting that the double copy really is ubiquitous in gravity, even if it's not at all obvious when you look at the Einstein-Hilbert Lagrangian. So we can certainly get gravitational waves from the double copy. I would like to understand bound states more, and maybe be interesting to make more connection to celestial holography. Seems to be a lot of ingredients that are, obviously a lot of the ingredients are the same. Okay, yeah. So that's what I wanted to say. Oh, no, I found my Stark video. It's always like that.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Let's thank
Nada. Sorry for going over.
Oh, no, that's definitely my fault. for the last bullet point, you basically, I think you just want to start computing the Val, like other Val tensor components near the corner, like near the spatial infinity, I guess, would be in this. One thing.
Indeed. Yeah, I mean, that might be very illuminating, actually. Yeah.
Or if you can't do that, just take your integrals of your curvature tensor, and then you got our basis.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of interesting things to think about. Yeah, I mean, I also think, you know, this business of rather than computing expectation values, computing the actual state, it's acting on psi with the net, that's very interesting and thought-provoking.
And I think there should be nothing wrong. I mean, like, basically the only thing you're doing there is you're computing an ingredient for your inclusive quantity too. So like it should
I mean, what's, well, I mean, SI obviously is, you know, complete information. So
Maybe questions on that. So do you expect that this would work if you look at the dominant component of psi 3 and then psi 2 and et cetera, psi 1 and psi 0? Would that still work, or you would have, you know, this would correspond to computing the 1/r corrections to your psi 4 corrections, but
yeah, I mean,
you expect that it would be some mixing and it's intractable? Or
I certainly can go ahead and start computing higher order components of the file spinner.
Computing the dominant component of psi 3.
No reason why one couldn't do that. I don't think so. I mean,
this linearized technique would be enough, you think? Or
I would presumably need to include corrections to the Riemann tensor operator in the quantum field theory.
I
will have H squared terms in the Riemann tensor operator.
No, but the H squared term would be the same thing. There would be 1/r, there would be subdominant in R for psi cube.
Yeah, but psi 3 is going to be subdominant in R, right? Psi 3 starts at 1/r².
Yeah, exactly. So then you can just look at, you can isolate. So the dominant contribution of psi is 1/r². Can you just use the same trick there?
I think so. Yes, I haven't done this, but yeah, I think so. So I mean, one way to think about this, which might be helpful, is there's nothing to stop me from computing the H, the metric, you know, the expectation value of the metric. There's nothing to stop me from computing that as a power series. You know, I'd have to choose some gauge or something like that, right? But there's really nothing stopping me from going ahead and computing that. And now I can, you know, if I've got that H, it's essentially the classical metric, some gauge, I can feed that into classical formulae for whatever component of the curvature you want, and I'll get the right answer.
There's one subtle question, I guess, in that line. So I agree, like when you're going to this like 2-2 signature thing, it's like you're going on shell and then you're kind of analytic continuing, and somehow like something like the bond, like things that are not actually radiative, like the values of these, a little, well, you can get all the U evolution, sure, but there should be like some extra data, which are these charges that Laurent and I and our friends or whatever.
Maybe I should say, so when I was talking about, you know, psi 3, I really had more in mind, the scattering case. So, you know, so if I got two black holes, I have no problem computing psi 3. I just don't think there'd be any problem there. Computing psi 3, and I think so. If you want me to compute higher order components of the Riemann curvature of Schwarzschild, for example, so then you would indeed run into more of the issues about coordinate choice. Mm-hmm. And those are more opaque to me. I think indeed it's something to do with how you're defining the Fourier transforms. So I won't be as strong in my statements about those components. Yeah, that's definitely more interesting. I mean, it's also true, and it's potentially an issue, that the analytic continuation has its issues. I analytically continue to 2-2, perform my integrals. And then there's parts of the curvature in 2-2 signature which are very distributional. They're localized on light cones in 2-2 signature, which simply aren't there in Minkowski. So to analytically continue back to Minkowski, you throw those away and then analytically continue the rest. So now it was straightforward to do that for various type D things. I mean, we also considered sort of more heterotic situations where it's not just Einstein gravity, but you have additional scalar fields, deltons, and axions switched up. But straightforward to do that for psi 4. For psi 3, I don't know. Yes, I don't want to be as strong in my statement. Mm-hmm.
Could you say more about one of the things you mentioned in the middle, which is this exponentiation of the 5-point amplitude? Yeah, yeah. yeah, you know, it's natural in the iconal, it's natural in the soft sector. But yes. Here, is it related? I mean, is there a reason why it has to be there? In the soft sector, we know it's related to symmetry, but I don't know, in the iconal, kind of the same here. How do people establish that and what is known about that amazing property?
So the idea here is so that this is supposed to hold only in the classical regime. So we're throwing away, there's some terminology. So these amplitudes have some expansion, and you can think about it in two ways. You can think about it as an expansion in large masses, so a HQET type expansion, or an expansion in H bar. And essentially, I'm keeping the terms here which are relevant classically, and throwing away the terms which are suppressed in this classical treatment. Mm-hmm. So then the intuition behind this is, classically speaking, complete information about the final state is where the particles are going on the radiation field. So this term here, this iconal light term, tells you about where the particles are going. This part here tells you about the radiation field. They should be complete information about the classical parts of the final state. That's essentially the intuition. In terms of checks, well, there are some checks. The checks are sort of expand this thing out. It makes various predictions about, funny sort of amplitude, 6-point amplitudes. So you can take a 5-point amplitude and hit it with a 4-point amplitude. You know, there has to be some factorization properties. So there are a few checks. There aren't very many checks. And well, this conjecture is, due to me and my collaborators. It does reproduce, so there was some encouraging work on this by Devecchia and friends. So there's radiation reaction that has to couple these things together. And this thing correctly captures the radiation reaction going beyond the soft limit. Gabriele, I should say, this group have, they wrote down a similar formula, but in the soft limit. So that's not the same as the classical limit, but it's not unrelated to the classical limit. So on the soft limit, something like this follows essentially directly from the Weinberg soft terms. But going beyond, soft and classical aren't the same. The soft limit captures the low frequency limit of the classical, but this is supposed to be the full classical. So now I've also written this down schematically, and I'm confident that a formula like this is true, but again, it's my work, so I guess I should be confident about it. However, there are various details. There are certain integrals here, which I haven't even bothered trying to write out properly. And those integrals couple these things together. And exactly how those integrals are, exactly what those integrals are, I don't know. I think it's fair to say we have a proposal for it, but I would presume that we didn't, I would presume that the correct version will have some very clever arrangement of these integrals. Essentially, there's some entanglement. I mean, even though I'm talking about the classical stuff, there's some entanglement between these this radiation field and the particles. Anyway, I think this is interesting. It's worth saying that when you expand this thing out, because there's a creation operator here, this thing populates terms with any number of gravitons in it. So it touches amplitudes of all points. And because these things have their own perturbative expansion, it touches all loops and all legs. So it's a very powerful state.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it would be nice to have more evidence for it. I mean, I'd say the evidence isn't, if there isn't a wealth of evidence, that would be a fair statement.
Thanks.
But one question, I guess you could imagine trying to create what out state would have a coherent state of whatever radiation you want. And that's not saying that it's generic or whatever, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, you can always write the out states on a basis of coherent states.
Yeah. Okay. But so there's some kind of overcompleteness, right? That's a problem.
Yeah, there's no overcompleteness. Yeah, exactly. It's also, one thing to say, calling this a coherent state mightn't really be, it might be slightly not quite right. I mean, this factor here is coherent-like, but there's definitely crosstalk between these things together, and the whole state itself isn't the form of a coherent state. So as an example, so coherent states, you know, one needs to normalize them. But in this story, there's already some terms in here. You know, it's known that this iconal stuff is not unitary, beyond some number of loops. So, I mean, the lack of unitarity here is being balanced by the by dumping probability into this graviton state. So this thing is all normalized on its own. Yeah, it doesn't need any further normalization. So, yeah, so there really is some crosstalk between these two parts.
And where is the, to keep track of things. So you have this two particle state, you're looking at
the two particle states, you know, its origin is, you know, the initial state of two particles, right?
Q and K is like the additional graviton.
K is. So there's going to be some bunch of gravitons. So these X's here are some integrals which are connecting these things all together. Mm-hmm. Now the X's start out life essentially as Fourier transforms of variables. So yeah, let's say that Q there is probably not a very felicitous choice of notation. That should probably be Mandelstam S or something. The X really starts out life. Well, I know why it's there. But anyway, the X essentially starts out life as being a Fourier transform of a momentum transfer. So that's the X in this iconal object. The X's in this object, again, are Fourier transforms of momentum transfers, the two of them.
Yeah, if you wanted to try to prove it, I guess it's weird for like a generic out state, but you could try to ask like what happens if I cut off my space-time surface and then go a little bit in from Scry Plus. This is supposed to be the behavior of
That's really right. Yes, I mean, obviously, I'm you know, thinking about the amplitude, so they're like the large distance tails, but indeed.
No, I mean, like I would do the amplitude as basically like if you're in an inclusive process, like if you told me all the particles hang out, I would say it's like a path integral from like the data on screen minus Scry Plus.
That's right. So there is, we wrote something a little along those lines. So it's most easy to make contact with path integral, you know, approaches, again, in the soft region. So you can sort of understand, the soft part of this from path integral formulas. And we wrote a little bit about that. Yeah. So you could embed this in a path integral form. So yeah, I mean, I guess in that respect, this you're talking about some boundary conditions as well.
Cool. Okay, Davide, do you want to say hi? I know people who overlap with Donald at the IS, they want to say.
Thank you. Bye.
I don't know. Good to see you. It's been many years. Okay. Should we let everybody go? Thanks for the invitation. So it was great talking to you. It's wonderful having so many good questions and enjoyable discussion. So thanks, William.
Yeah, sorry for slowing you down. That was definitely all my fault, but thanks.
It's great to have some enthusiasm. Awesome. All right. Have a good day, everybody. Bye. Bye.